Welcome to the History Maps podcast. We are jumping right into a blinding snowstorm in March of 1461. A soldier is standing there, and the wind is howling so loudly across this frozen Yorkshire field that he cannot even hear the orders of the guy standing right next to him.
Right, the conditions are just completely brutal.
Yeah, and suddenly these heavy arrows start falling out of the whiteout. They're tearing through the ranks, slaughtering the men around him, and he cannot even see who is shooting at them.
Because the wind is blowing directly into his face?
Exactly. So any arrow his own side fires back just drops harmlessly into the snowdrifts mid-flight.
Which is a terrifying position to be in.
It really is. I mean, this is not some modern, beyond visual range artillery strike. This is the Battle of Towton.
The bloodiest single day in English history.
Right. Up to 28,000 men would die in that freezing snow. So today, our mission is to untangle the 32-year dynastic blood feud that led to that horrifying moment.
It is a critical period to examine.
A feud that, you know, permanently altered the course of English history, completely destroyed the Plantagenet dynasty, and gave rise to the Tudors.
And this deep dive is part of our medieval history series. We are working from a really robust stack of sources for this one.
Yeah, we have encyclopedic accounts, detailed historical records, timeline data, all of it.
Exactly. We will use these to explore the intricate web of battles, betrayals, and political shifts that occurred between 1455 and 1487.
But before we get into the heavy armor and the betrayals, we need to clear up a foundational fact from the sources.
Right, the name itself.
Exactly. The participants themselves did not call this conflict the Wars of the Roses.
I mean, if you walked up to a soldier at that frozen battlefield at Towton and asked him about the Wars of the Roses, he would have absolutely no idea what you were talking about.
Right. They referred to it as the Civil Wars or, you know, the Cousins' War.
It is a vital distinction to make right at the start. We are looking at a conflict that was deeply fragmented and constantly shifting.
So that famous imagery, the neat binary conflict between the White Rose of York and the Red Rose of Lancaster, where does that come from?
That was largely popularized centuries later by novelists like Sir Walter Scott. For the people actually living through it, there was no color-coded narrative.
It was just a chaotic, highly localized struggle for survival, wealth, and supremacy.
Exactly. The combined Tudor Rose that you might be picturing right now, that was essentially a post-war branding exercise by King Henry VII.
Okay, so by understanding that the Wars of the Roses is a retrospective ladle, you can start to see the conflict for what it actually was.
Right. A bitter, multi-generational struggle over the ultimate prize, the undisputed right to rule the kingdom.
So to understand how a unified kingdom fractured so completely, we first have to look at the royal family tree.
Which is quite complicated.
It really is. We have to look at the dangerous precedent set decades before the fighting actually began.
So we start with King Edward III, who ruled from 1327 to 1377.
Right. And if you look at the lineage descending from him, it branches out in a way that practically guarantees conflict. Because Edward III had multiple sons who survived to adulthood.
Which is usually a good thing for a king, but here it sets up a massive problem.
Yeah. The House of Lancaster claimed legitimacy through his third surviving son, John of Gaunt. Meanwhile, the House of York descended from the fourth surviving son, Edmund of Langley.
But here is the critical part, the detail that throws everything into chaos.
Right.
The Yorkists also claimed a superior lineage through the female line of Edward's second surviving son, Lionel of Antwerp.
And that genealogical split is essentially the engine of the entire conflict.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
The Lancastrian claim was based firmly on male line descent.
I look at the Plantagenet family tree, almost like a poorly written legal will.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, it's like two distinct branches of a family have highly plausible yet totally conflicting claims to the exact same estate.
Right, and John of Gaunt's son, Henry Bolingbroke, forced the issue. He deposed his cousin, King Richard II, in 1399, taking the throne as King Henry IV.
And then Henry IV had Parliament validate his line, essentially arguing that physical possession of the crown and direct male descent trumped everything else.
But the Yorkists eventually argued that proximity of blood mattered more, even if that bloodline passed through a female heir.
Because Lionel of Antwerp was the second son.
Exactly. So his descendants theoretically had a stronger claim than the descendants of the third son, John of Gaunt.
I'm struggling to see why this matters 50 years later, though.
How do you mean?
Well, by the 1450s, the Lancastrians had been sitting on the throne for three generations. Henry IV, Henry V, and now Henry VI.
Right.
So, like, if I take over a piece of land and my family lives there for half a century without anyone stopping me, eventually everyone just accepts it as my land.
That is usually how it works, yes.
Right. Was the war essentially inevitable the moment Henry IV took the throne by force? Was it just a delayed fuse time bomb, or was this female line claim just an excuse they dusted off when it was convenient?
What's fascinating here is how the concept of medieval kingship interacts with raw power.
Okay.
You are right that time usually cements authority. The problem is how that authority was initially seized.
In 1399.
Yes. When Henry IV usurped Richard II, he established a very dangerous new rule in English politics.
Yeah.
Might makes right.
Because prior to that, a king was supposed to be chosen by God.
Right.
Born into the role by divine providence.
Exactly. To remove a king was to defy God. But Henry IV proved that a throne could be taken by force on the battlefield.
And Parliament could simply rubber stamp it afterward.
Which meant he left all his successors constantly needing to watch their backs.
So the moral shield of kingship is permanently shattered. The divine right is exposed as a myth, or, well, at least a myth that can be pierced by a sharp enough sword.
Exactly. If you can take the throne by force once, it stands to reason someone else can do it to your heirs if they show weakness.
And the Yorkists really weaponized this exact history in the 1450s and 60s.
They did. They did not frame their rebellion as destroying a legitimate government. They framed the Lancastrian kings as three generations of illegal squatters.
They argued that the true divine succession had been interrupted in 1399.
And that they were simply restoring the proper God-given order.
But, you know, a disputed bloodline is really only a theory until people have the practical means to enforce it.
Right. A genealogical chart does not win a war.
You need money, and you need manpower. And the economic and social landscape of the mid-15th century provided exactly the right kind of fuel for this fire.
The situation was incredibly dire.
Yeah. By 1453, the Hundred Years' War with France had ended in total disaster for England. They had lost all their French territories except for the port city of Calais.
Which was not just a blow to national pride, it was a financial catastrophe.
The sources emphasize this heavily. The crown was severely impoverished.
The government was deeply in debt, owing well over £200,000.
Which was an astronomical sum at the time.
And to make matters worse, there was a massive slump in international trade. The loss of the French territories cannot be overstated as a destabilizing factor.
Because for decades, English nobles had enriched themselves on French lands, ransoms, and loot, right?
Exactly. Suddenly, they were pushed out, and all those aggressive, battle-hardened men returned to England looking for ways to maintain their incomes.
While at the same time, the English crown was deprived of substantial customs revenues.
So you have a central government running chronic deficits, resorting to excessive borrowing and forced loans, which deeply alienated the taxpayers and the merchants.
Okay, let's unpack this economic situation, because it directly feeds into a fundamental shift in how English society was organized.
You were talking about bastard feudalism.
Yes, the sources refer to this a lot. Let's break down how this actually worked, because it is quite different from what we usually picture.
Under traditional feudalism, say, back in the days of William the Conqueror, a king gave a lord land. And in exchange, that lord provided military service with knights from that specific land.
It was deeply tied to geography.
But bastard feudalism severs that tie. Powerful landowners stopped relying on land for loyalty.
Instead, they maintained massive private armies of retainers who were paid in hard cash.
Correct. Instead of a tenant farmer owing you 40 days of military service a year because he lives on your land, you are now handing out contracts.
Yeah, you pay knights and soldiers annual fees, annuities, to be part of your personal retinue.
And these soldiers wore livery badges to loudly declare who was paying them. You might wear the bare and ragged staff of the Earl of Warwick.
Or the silver swan of the Duke of Buckingham.
Exactly.
I look at bastard feudalism almost like a kingdom outsourcing its military to independent, private military contractors.
That is a very apt comparison.
Right. The soldiers are entirely loyal to the CEO who signs their paychecks. Not the state, and certainly not the king.
Hmm.
It feels incredibly dangerous.
It was.
Did the crown essentially finance its own downfall by allowing these micro-armies to exist?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the crown did not really have a choice. The central government was simply too broke to maintain a permanent standing army of its own.
So they had to rely on these wealthy nobles to raise troops when the country needed defending.
But as those unpaid soldiers returned from the losses in France, they swelled the ranks of these private retinues.
And the most powerful regional barons, often referred to in the sources as overmighty subjects, became local warlords.
Their word was law in their respective territories because they possessed the physical force to back it up.
Which means the entire country's stability hinged on one thing, a strong, active king who could keep these overmighty subjects in line.
Precisely. A strong king like Henry V could focus that martial energy outward toward France.
But a weak king meant those private armies would inevitably turn inward, fighting over local resources and influence at court.
And this localized power vacuum meant that any national dispute could instantly mobilize thousands of armed men across the countryside.
So we have private armies primed for a fight, a royal treasury that is completely empty, and the latent excuse of competing claims to the throne.
The country is a powder keg.
It really is. All it needed was a crisis of leadership. And in August 1453, that crisis arrives in the most catastrophic way possible.
King Henry VI suffers a complete mental collapse.
There's a profound tragedy that paralyzed the government.
Henry VI was already known as a deeply pious, conflict-averse, and generally weak ruler who was easily manipulated by his court favorites.
But the event in August 1453 was entirely different. The sources indicate he became entirely catatonic.
He was unable to speak, unable to move his own limbs without assistance, and completely unaware of his surroundings.
He didn't even recognize his own newborn son, Edward of Westminster, when the child was presented to him.
The timing could not have been worse.
The king is effectively incapacitated. The queen, Margaret of Anjou, is terrified for her new son's inheritance, and the overmighty subjects are surfling.
In this total vacuum of royal authority, someone had to govern. And Richard, Duke of York, was eventually appointed Lord Protector in 1454.
York is a crucial figure here, right? He was immensely wealthy, and he possessed that powerful alternative claim to the throne through the female line we discussed earlier.
Yes, and he viewed himself as a necessary reformer. He genuinely believed it was his duty to fix the corrupt, bankrupt government that had formed around the incapacitated king.
And during his protectorate, Richard of York actually gets to work. He enacts administrative reforms, and crucially, he imprisons his chief political rival, Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset.
Somerset was a massive favorite of the Lancastrian court and had been heavily blamed for the military disasters in France.
So York is cleaning house. He is ruling, effectively.
He is, but his actions terrified Queen Margaret.
Right.
She viewed Richard of York not as a reformer, but as a massive existential threat to her son's succession.
She saw him consolidating power, removing her allies like Somerset, and positioning himself just one step away from the crown itself.
And then, early in 1455, the worst possible thing for Richard of York happens.
Henry VI suddenly wakes up.
He recovers his senses, and almost immediately, the king reverses all of York's reforms.
He releases Somerset from the Tower of London and restores him to his prominent position at court.
This reversal is driven heavily by Margaret of Anjou. She moves decisively to exclude York and his allies from any position of influence.
The tension finally snaps on May 22, 1455, leading to the First Battle of St. Albans.
Now, when you hear the word battle, you might picture two massive armies lining up on a wide green field.
But St. Albans was not that. It was a vicious, violent street fight.
Exactly. The royal army, led by Somerset, barricades themselves inside the town of St. Albans.
Richard of York's forces are outside. For hours, they try to break through the town barricades and fail.
But then Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick, who is allied with York, does something completely unexpected.
He manages to flank the Lancastrian defenses by hacking his way through the private gardens and back alleys of the town.
It was a brutal tactical maneuver. Warwick's men burst into the town square, catching the royal forces completely by surprise.
The fighting in the streets was intense and personal. Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, was cornered outside an inn and hacked to death.
Other key Lancastrian nobles were specifically targeted and killed.
And King Henry VI himself took an arrow to the neck and was captured by the Yorkists, found sitting quietly under a tree as the chaos swirled around him.
The sources make it clear that St. Albans irrevocably changed the rules of engagement.
By deliberately targeting and executing Lancastrian nobles like Somerset during the fighting, the Yorkists crossed a massive line.
They turned what had been a tense political dispute over the control of the court into a multi-generational blood feud.
The sons of the men killed at St. Albans would spend the rest of their lives seeking vengeance against York and Warwick.
That is the tragedy of St. Albans. It introduced blood into the political arena.
I look at the situation just before St. Albans, and it reminds me of a modern corporate boardroom crisis.
How so?
Well, the CEO, Henry, is incapacitated. The board appoints a competent COO, York, to fix the company.
Right.
But when the CEO wakes up, he fires the COO at the urging of his spouse. Which makes me wonder about York's true motivations. Was he driven by a genuine desire to reform a corrupt state? Or was it just a pure hunger for the crown from the very beginning?
That is what makes York such a complex figure. The sources show that York initially treated the captured Henry VI with deep deference.
Because after he wins the street fight and captures the king, he doesn't take the crown, right?
Exactly. Following St. Albans, York escorted the wounded king back to London, presented himself on his knees, and sought to rule through him as protector once again.
His goal, at least initially, was to control the king, to remove the corrupt advisors, not to depose the monarch.
Taking the crown in 1455 was still legally and morally unthinkable to most of the nobility.
But coexistence was essentially impossible at this point. Margaret of Anjou's fierce protection of her son's birthright meant she would never accept York's authority, no matter how much deference he showed the king.
She systematically worked to build a new power base, moving the court to the Midlands, away from York's influence in London.
And this failure to find political compromise guaranteed that the subsequent clashes would be fought for total annihilation.
St. Albans drew the first blood, but the escalation over the next 5 years is staggering. Both sides spent that time raising larger armies and deepening their animosity.
Which leads us to 1459. The Lancastrian faction convenes a parliament in Coventry, which goes down in history as the Parliament of Devils.
And this parliament passes a series of attainders against the Yorkists.
Let's take a moment to explain the mechanics of an attainder, because this isn't just getting fired from a government post.
Not at all. An act of attainder is one of the most severe legal weapons in medieval English law.
It essentially declares a person guilty of treason without a trial, right?
Yes, but the crucial mechanism is the corruption of blood. When you are attainted, you do not just lose your own lands, titles, and life.
Your bloodline is legally corrupted.
Meaning your children and heirs are permanently disinherited. They can never inherit property or titles. It is a legal erasure of your family's entire future.
So when the Parliament of Devils attaints Richard of York and his allies, they are literally backing them into a corner where they have absolutely nothing to lose.
Their families are ruined unless they fight back.
And fight back they do. The Yorkists retaliate with military force. They win a major victory at the Battle of Northampton in 1460, and they capture King Henry VI a second time.
This sets the stage for a shocking political maneuver. Richard of York returns from exile in Ireland, walks into Parliament, and places his hand on the empty throne.
He expected the assembled nobility to acclaim him as king.
But they don't.
They meet him in total silence.
The Archbishop of Canterbury finally asks him if he would like to go see the king.
And York angrily replies that he knows no person in the realm who should not come to him instead.
But the nobility simply had no desire to depose an anointed king, even a weak one.
So they forge a desperate legal compromise known as the Act of Accord in October 1460.
This act officially declares that Henry VI will remain king for the rest of his natural life.
But Richard of York and his heirs are named as the official successors, completely disinheriting Henry's own son, Prince Edward.
The Act of Accord was entirely unacceptable to Queen Margaret. Disinheriting the rightful prince violated every fundamental law of succession.
She immediately began rallying a massive Lancastrian army in the north, primarily in Yorkshire, to destroy York once and for all and restore her son's inheritance.
That leads directly to the Battle of Wakefield on December 30, 1460.
Richard of York marches north to deal with this Lancastrian army. He takes up a defensive position inside Sandal Castle.
But for reasons that historians still debate, whether he was tricked, whether he thought the enemy force was smaller than it was, or whether his supplies were running out,
York leaves the safety of the castle to face the Lancastrians in the open.
It was a catastrophic tactical error. York's forces were vastly outnumbered and completely routed.
Richard of York was killed in the fighting. His second son, the Earl of Rutland, was brutally murdered while trying to flee.
The Lancastrians then made a horrifying spectacle of York's death. They severed his head, placed a mock crown made of paper on it, and displayed it on the gates of the city of York.
It is meant to be the ultimate humiliation. The man who reached for the crown gets one made of paper in death.
But York's death does not end the war. It simply passes his claim down to his eldest son, Edward, Earl of March.
who was 18 years old, standing over 6 feet tall, and already proving to be a brilliant military commander.
Just weeks after his father's death, Edward faces a Lancastrian army at the Battle of Mortimer's Cross in February 1461.
And this battle is preceded by a profound meteorological event.
Right before the battle begins, the troops look up at the freezing winter sky and witness a parhelion.
An optical phenomenon caused by ice crystals in the atmosphere that creates the illusion of three suns shining simultaneously.
You can imagine the absolute terror this would cause in a medieval army.
They see three suns and immediately assume it is a harbinger of doom, a sign that God is angry.
But Edward, Earl of March, shows immense charisma and presence of mind. Instead of letting his troops panic, he immediately spins the phenomenon as a divine omen of victory.
He tells his men that the three suns represent the Holy Trinity shining down to bless their cause.
He adopts the sun in splendor as his personal emblem and rallies his troops to a decisive victory.
He turns potential panic into powerful political propaganda. But the true test of Edward's military capability comes shortly after, at the Battle of Towton on March 29, 1461.
We mentioned this in the introduction, but we need to dive into the scale of what happened here.
Towton remains the largest and bloodiest battle ever fought on English soil. Over 50,000 men were involved, fighting in the middle of a blinding snowstorm on Palm Sunday.
The tactical realities of Towton are horrifying. The Yorkist commander, Lord Fauconberg, recognized that the wind was blowing fiercely from the south.
Directly into the faces of the Lancastrian army.
Right. He ordered his archers to step forward, fire a single volley of specialized flight arrows into the blinding snow, and then immediately step back.
The Lancastrians are hit by these arrows, they cannot see where they're coming from, and they assume the Yorkists have advanced into range.
So the Lancastrian archers fire back.
But because they're firing directly into a gale force headwind, their arrows fall completely short, landing harmlessly in the snow, 50 yards ahead of the Yorkist lines.
The Lancastrians emptied their quivers into the snow.
Once they stopped firing, Fauconberg ordered his men to advance again, draw their own arrows, and crucially, pull the spent Lancastrian arrows out of the snow and fire them right back at the enemy.
It is a devastating tactic.
The Lancastrians are taking massive casualties from long-range fire, and they have no choice. They have to abandon their defensive position on the high ground and advance blindly into the snow just to engage in hand-to-hand combat.
And from there, it is a 10-hour meat grinder. Men are hacking at each other in the freezing cold until the snow turns red.
The sheer scale of the slaughter at Towton marks the definitive death of chivalric warfare in England, doesn't it?
Absolutely. In earlier centuries, the primary goal of battle was often to capture wealthy nobles and ransom them back to their families.
But at Towton, strict orders were given on both sides to yield no quarter.
Ransom was no longer an option. The objective was the total eradication of the opposing leadership. Up to 28,000 men died on that field or drowned in the freezing waters of the Cockbeck River while desperately trying to escape.
Okay, let's unpack this. 28,000 men dead in a single day.
It is a staggering number.
I liken Fauconberg's archery tactic in the snow to modern beyond visual range artillery strikes earlier, but I struggled to comprehend how a nation that had already survived the catastrophic population loss of the Black Death a century earlier could sustain such a localized demographic slaughter.
It is a profound question.
How does the country not completely collapse when that many fighting-age men are wiped out in one afternoon?
Well, to contextualize those casualties, you have to look at who is actually doing the fighting and dying.
Okay.
The nobility was absolutely decimated. That was a severe demographic hit to the ruling class, extinguishing several ancient noble lines entirely. However, the broader socioeconomic fabric of England remains surprisingly intact.
Wait, really? How is that possible?
Because contemporary observers noted that the Wars of the Roses were a very unique kind of war. The violence was largely confined to the armies themselves on the battlefield.
So no pillaging?
Mostly, no. Unlike the Hundred Years' War in France, where English armies systematically burned civilian crops and infrastructure to break the enemy's economy, the combatants in England largely avoided destroying the countryside.
Because they were fighting to rule England. They did not want to inherit a wasteland.
Exactly. If you were a peasant living in a village, you might not even know the battle was happening unless an army marched directly through your field. The infrastructure survived, allowing the country to absorb the shock of the casualties.
So the peasant economy continues to function while the lords slaughter each other. Following the victory at Towton, Edward, Earl of March, is crowned King Edward IV.
He won the crown through brilliant military tactics and, crucially, the vast wealth and power of his primary ally, Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick.
Warwick becomes known to history as the Kingmaker, but winning a throne is entirely different from sharing it.
That tension defines the next decade. Warwick was immensely powerful. He was the captain of Calais, which meant he controlled England's only standing military garrison.
He possessed a vast network of retainers.
And he saw himself not just as a senior advisor, but almost as a co-ruler. He believed he had placed Edward on the throne, and therefore, Edward should follow his direction.
And Warwick's grand strategic vision relies on a French alliance.
Yes.
While Warwick is over in France, spending months negotiating a highly prestigious diplomatic marriage for the young King Edward to a French princess, Edward does something that throws a grenade into the entire political landscape.
On May 1st, 1464, he secretly marries Elizabeth Woodville.
The secret marriage to Elizabeth Woodville was a political earthquake. Elizabeth was a Lancastrian widow.
Her first husband had actually died fighting against Edward at the Second Battle of St. Albans.
She was older than Edward. She already had two children. And she was of relatively minor knightly status.
She was not a foreign princess. She brought no international alliances, no dowry, and no strategic advantage to the kingdom.
The narrative often told is that Edward was simply blinded by lust. Elizabeth famously refused to be his mistress, so he married her to get her into his bed.
But the fallout is massive. The Woodville family rapidly ascends at court. Elizabeth has five brothers and seven unmarried sisters.
The Woodvilles aggressively capitalized on their new royal connection. They monopolized all the advantageous marriages in the kingdom for their extensive family.
The queen's sisters were married off to the heirs of various earldoms and dukedoms, effectively scooping up all the eligible heirs and isolating Warwick from forging his own strategic marital alliances.
This secret marriage has always baffled me. If you compare it to a modern political campaign, it is like a candidate completely alienating their primary financial and strategic backer, the person who essentially bought them the election, just for a personal whim.
It does look that way, yes.
Did Edward IV bring the subsequent rebellion entirely upon himself through sheer arrogance? Or was there an actual political strategy behind marrying a commoner and uplifting her entire family?
This raises an important question regarding the expectations of power in the 15th century. Edward was a young, highly capable, and fiercely independent monarch.
He recognized that Warwick's influence was stifling his own authority.
He had to break Warwick's monopoly on power to be a true king in his own right.
So creating a new loyal faction out of the Woodvilles was a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. The Woodvilles owed their entire elevation to Edward. Therefore, they would be fiercely loyal to him, unlike Warwick, who felt Edward owed him.
The marriage, while deeply unpopular with the old nobility, was a deliberate assertion of independent royal prerogative.
The fatal flaw in Edward's calculation was the timing. He alienated his greatest domestic ally before he had secured a strong foreign alliance, which left him incredibly vulnerable when Warwick eventually turned against him.
And turn he did. Warwick's pride is shattered. He orchestrates a rebellion in 1469 under the alias Robin of Reedsdale, managing to defeat royal forces at the Battle of Edgecote.
He even briefly captures King Edward.
But Warwick quickly realizes a fundamental truth about English politics. You cannot simply rule the country while holding a capable adult king prisoner.
The rest of the nobility refused to cooperate with Warwick's shadow government.
Recognizing his failure, Warwick takes an incredible pivot. He flees to France, seeking the backing of the French king, Louis XI.
And Louis engineers one of the most stunning, pragmatic compromises in diplomatic history. He brokers an alliance between Warwick the Kingmaker and his former bitter enemy, Margaret of Anjou.
It is hard to overstate how deeply these two despised each other. Warwick had literally paraded Henry VI through the streets of London as a captive with his legs tied to his horse.
Margaret of Anjou had executed Warwick's father after the Battle of Wakefield. There is a sea of blood between them.
But their mutual hatred of Edward IV unites them.
It was the ultimate marriage of convenience. Margaret needed Warwick's military capability and influence in England to restore her husband and son.
Warwick needed a royal figurehead to legitimize his return to power.
Together, they engineer what becomes known as the Readeption, the restoration of Henry VI to the throne in October 1470.
Edward IV is completely caught off guard by this invasion and is forced to flee the country, escaping to Burgundy with just a small retinue.
Henry VI is taken out of the Tower of London, dusted off, and put back on the throne.
But Henry's rule is incredibly fragile. He is wholly dependent on Warwick's military control and French backing.
And Edward's exile was remarkably brief. Armed with financial and naval support from the Duke of Burgundy, who is alarmed by Warwick's alliance with France.
Edward returns to England in the spring of 1471 to settle the score once and for all.
This leads us to the Battle of Barnet on April 14, 1471.
And this battle is a perfect study in the chaos of medieval warfare. It is fought in thick, disorienting morning fog. Visibility is almost zero.
The battle lines were completely misaligned in the fog. The right wing of both armies overlapped the left wing of their opponents.
The Earl of Oxford, fighting for the Lancastrian alliance under Warwick, managed to completely rout the Yorkist left wing and chase them off the field.
But the fog is so thick that the rest of the army doesn't even know this has happened.
Oxford manages to rally his men and bring them back to the battlefield to hit Edward's forces in the rear.
But as they emerge from the fog, a catastrophic friendly fire incident occurs.
Oxford's men are wearing his livery badge, which features the Veer Star, a star with streaming rays.
In the gloom and confusion, the Lancastrian center mistakes Oxford's streaming star for King Edward's own badge, the Sun in Splendor.
Believing they are being attacked by the enemy, the Lancastrians open fire on their own returning troops.
Oxford's men, assuming they have been betrayed by Warwick, scream treason and flee the field.
The entire Lancastrian army collapses in confusion and panic. Warwick the Kingmaker realizes the battle is lost and attempts to flee to his horse.
But he is caught by Yorkist soldiers, dragged down, and killed.
The death of Warwick removed the most capable political and military strategist the Lancastrian alliance possessed.
But Edward could not rest. On the exact same day as the Battle of Barnet, Margaret of Anjou and her son, Prince Edward, finally landed in the west of England with a fresh army.
Edward IV immediately marches his exhausted troops across the country to intercept them, resulting in the Battle of Tewkesbury on May 4, 1471.
Tewkesbury is where the Lancastrian cause is finally crushed. Margaret's forces are caught in a difficult position.
The terrain is full of marshy ground, deep ditches, and thick hedges.
The Lancastrian commander, the Duke of Somerset, the son of the man killed at the First Battle of St. Albans, attempts a daring flanking maneuver.
He tries to lead his men through a wooded area to strike the Yorkist flank.
But the terrain works against him. The maneuver is incredibly slow, and Edward spots it.
He sends a detachment of spearmen into the woods, who crash into Somerset's forces.
The flanking maneuver fails completely and turns into a terrifying rout.
The Lancastrians are pushed back into a meadow that becomes known as the Bloody Meadow. During the slaughter, Prince Edward of Westminster, the sole legitimate Lancastrian heir, is killed.
Some sources say he died fleeing the field. Others claim he was captured and executed. Regardless, his death changes everything.
Barnet and Tewkesbury permanently extinguished the direct Lancastrian male line. With Prince Edward dead, there was no credible heir.
And to ensure absolute security, shortly after Edward IV returned victorious to London, King Henry VI, who had been imprisoned in the Tower once again, was quietly murdered while at prayer.
The official Yorkist report claimed he died of pure displeasure and melancholy. But absolutely no one believed that.
No. His skull, when examined centuries later, showed clear evidence of blunt force trauma.
The Lancastrian cause was effectively dead.
Yeah.
This allowed Edward IV to rule for over a decade in relative peace.
Without a rival claimant to rally around, the nobility fell in line. Edward focused on economic recovery, restoring the royal treasury, and stabilizing the realm.
But going back to Barnet for a moment, I really want to zero in on that fog of war and the friendly fire incident.
It is a remarkable moment.
It is incredible to me how a simple graphic design flaw in an era before standardized military uniforms literally changed the course of European history.
A star badge looking slightly too much like a sun badge in the mist causes an army to destroy itself.
Right.
It perfectly illustrates the fatal structural flaw of bastard feudalism.
Because the armies aren't standardized.
When your armies are not a standardized national force, but rather patched together from various private retinues, chaos is always just one weather event away.
The lack of standardized uniforms meant identification was entirely reliant on these specific heraldic badges.
When visibility dropped in the fog, the inherent weakness of relying on a patchwork of private armies was exposed with fatal consequences.
With the Lancastrians wiped out, the House of York enjoyed that long period of stability. But as we see so often in history, the Yorkists' greatest enemy would turn out to be themselves.
Edward IV, who was physically imposing and dominant, begins to succumb to a lifestyle of excess.
He dies unexpectedly in April 1483, likely from illness exacerbated by his lifestyle. He is only 40 years old.
His son, Edward V, is only 12. Suddenly, the kingdom is thrust back into the one scenario everyone dreaded, a minority rule.
And minority rules always breed factionalism. The Woodville family, the relatives of the queen, immediately move to maintain their grip on power by controlling the young king.
But Edward IV's younger brother, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, had been governing the north of England effectively for a decade.
He was a proven, capable administrator and military commander.
He intercepted the young king's entourage on their way to London, arrested the key Woodville leadership, and had himself named Lord Protector.
Up to this point, many in the nobility probably breathed a sigh of relief. Richard is dealing with the unpopular Woodvilles.
But Richard does not stop at being protector.
He claims the throne for himself, becoming King Richard III. To justify this, he produces a document known as the Titulus Regis.
Let's explain the legal minutiae of this, because it is crucial to his usurpation. The Titulus Regis relied on the concept of a pre-contract.
Richard presented evidence, sworn by a bishop, that before Edward IV married Elizabeth Woodville, he had secretly promised to marry another woman, Lady Eleanor Butler.
Under medieval canon law, a formal promise of marriage, if consummated, was legally binding and invalidated any subsequent marriage.
So Richard argues that Edward's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville was bigamous and invalid.
Therefore, all of their children, including the 12-year-old King Edward V, are illegitimate bastards who cannot inherit the throne.
It was a highly convenient legal loophole that allowed Richard to bypass his nephews and claim the crown as the rightful, legitimate heir of the House of York.
The young Edward and his younger brother were placed in the Tower of London, which was a traditional royal residence prior to a coronation, but also a prison.
They were seen playing in the courtyards for a few weeks, and then gradually they were withdrawn behind the inner walls.
And they famously disappear from history, becoming the princes in the tower.
The contemporary rumor mill immediately decides Richard had them murdered, and this usurpation fractures the Yorkist power base completely.
By declaring his nephews illegitimate and likely orchestrating their deaths, Richard crossed a moral line that horrified even his own supporters.
He alienated a massive block of diehard Yorkist loyalists who had spent decades serving his brother, Edward IV.
This division is what gave a relatively unknown exile a fighting chance.
Henry Tudor had been living in obscure exile in Brittany and France for 14 years.
He had an incredibly tenuous claim to the throne through the illegitimate Beaufort line of the House of Lancaster.
In normal circumstances, Henry Tudor would have been a historical footnote. But because Richard had so deeply divided the Yorkist establishment, Henry became the focal point for all opposition.
Rebellious Yorkists began fleeing across the channel to join him.
Henry Tudor lands in Wales in August 1485 with a small force of French mercenaries and loyal exiles.
He marches into England to confront Richard, culminating in the Battle of Bosworth Field on August 22, 1485.
Bosworth is a battle defined by betrayal. Richard III had a larger army, but the loyalty of his forces was highly suspect.
The battle reaches a dramatic climax when Richard spots Henry Tudor's banner on the field. Realizing that killing Henry would instantly end the rebellion, Richard leads a desperate, all-or-nothing cavalry charge directly at him.
It is incredibly close. Richard's charge smashes into Henry's personal guard. He kills Henry's standard bearer. He is within feet of Henry Tudor.
But on the sidelines of the battlefield, you have Sir William Stanley and Lord Stanley.
They command massive, pivotal forces, and they have just been sitting there watching the battle unfold, waiting to see who is going to win.
At this critical moment, they betray Richard. They order their forces to attack Richard's unprotected flank.
The Stanley intervention was decisive. Richard III was surrounded, dragged from his horse, and killed in the mud.
He was the last English king to die in battle.
So what does this all mean for Richard's legacy? The traditional Tudor narrative paints Richard III as this deformed, cartoonish villain whose sheer evil brought about his inevitable downfall.
But if we look at it pragmatically,
Richard's usurpation looks a lot like a hostile corporate takeover designed to prevent the company from going bankrupt.
That is an interesting way to frame it.
He was facing a weak 12-year-old king who was heavily controlled by a highly unpopular faction, the Woodvilles. Was Richard driven by a pragmatic need to avoid another disastrous, faction-torn reign like the one the country endured under Henry VI?
It is entirely plausible to view Richard's actions through the lens of harsh political realism.
He was not a cartoon villain. He was a proven, capable administrator who had been intensely loyal to his brother for decades.
A minority reign under Woodville control likely would have led to renewed civil war, as the Woodvilles sought to eliminate their rivals. Richard stepped in to prevent that.
However, even if his initial motives were pragmatic, the methods he used, specifically the deposition and disappearance of his nephews, crossed a boundary that destroyed the fundamental trust required to govern the entire realm.
The Stanley betrayal at Bosworth is proof that while Richard may have been seeking stability, his ruthless actions eroded the loyalty necessary to maintain it.
So Richard falls, and Henry Tudor wins the crown on the battlefield, becoming King Henry VII.
But winning the crown and keeping it are two very different things.
To survive, Henry had to definitively end the cycle of violence that had plagued England for 30 years. And he starts with a brilliant, if highly cynical, legal maneuver.
He dates the start of his reign to August 21, 1485, the exact day before the Battle of Bosworth.
By doing this, anyone who fought for Richard III the next day is legally classified as a traitor to the crown.
It allows Henry to seize their lands and wealth, significantly enriching the new Tudor dynasty right from the start.
It was a masterstroke of legal fiction. But Henry VII also recognized the desperate need for dynastic reconciliation.
In January 1486, he fulfills a political promise to marry Elizabeth of York, the eldest daughter of King Edward IV.
This marriage physically united the rival houses. And it is here that Henry heavily promotes the imagery of the Tudor rose.
He blends the white rose of York and the red rose of Lancaster into a single emblem to symbolize a new era of peace and unity.
But the Yorkists don't just quietly fade away after the wedding, do they?
No, Henry faces multiple bizarre yet highly dangerous pretenders to the throne.
First, you have Lambert Simnel, a young boy, likely a baker's son, who is trained to impersonate the Earl of Warwick.
It sounds absurd, but he actually manages to gather enough support from diehard Yorkists and Irish lords to be crowned king in Dublin.
He invades England and fights the Battle of Stoke Field in 1487, which Henry VII barely wins.
Then you have Perkin Warbeck, who spends years roaming the courts of Europe, claiming to be Richard, the younger of the princes in the Tower.
He gains support from foreign monarchs who want to destabilize Henry, before finally being captured and executed in 1499.
To ensure these endless rebellions stop, Henry enacts strict laws against livery and maintenance, heavily fining nobles who try to keep the private armies we talked about earlier.
But he doesn't stop there. He utilizes a financial weapon called bonds and recognizances.
Henry VII's true genius lay in his financial policies. These bonds were massive financial penalties that hung constantly over the heads of the nobility.
Essentially, a noble would be forced to sign a bond agreeing that they owed the king a ruinous sum of money, say, £10,000.
But that debt would only be collected if they stepped out of line, showed disloyalty, or kept an illegal private army.
It's historically ironic, really.
Yeah.
The entire conflict began because the crown under Henry VI was bankrupt and powerless.
Right.
Now, I look at Henry VII's financial bonds, and they operate more like a massive, kingdom-wide, modern non-disclosure agreement with ruinous financial penalties, or even mafia protection money.
That is an excellent way to conceptualize it.
The king is essentially saying, I hold a debt over your head that will destroy your family for generations. Step out of line, and I cash it in, bankrupting you instantly. Did Henry basically win the peace simply by out-accounting his enemies?
He really did. It effectively dismantled the entire system of bastard feudalism. Nobles could no longer afford to maintain private armies, not just because it was illegal, but because the financial risk of defying the king meant total, immediate bankruptcy.
Henry realized that true power lay not just on the battlefield, but in the ledger.
By systematically impoverishing any noble who posed a threat and centralizing all that wealth in the royal treasury, he fundamentally changed the structure of English government.
The Wars of the Roses transitioned England from a medieval state run by overmighty feudal warlords to an early modern centralized bureaucratic monarchy where power resided in the treasury, not the private armory.
It is a profound transformation.
And it brings us back to where we started today. The entire concept of the Wars of the Roses, the strict dichotomy of the red rose fighting the white rose, was largely a retroactive branding campaign invented by the Tudors.
They used it to legitimize their rule, making their victory seem like a neat divine resolution to a simple binary conflict culminating in the beautiful Tudor rose.
But as we have explored, it was actually a messy, chaotic, multifactional bloodbath driven by economics, ambition, the collapse of royal authority, and the structural flaws of bastard feudalism. If the defining symbols of one of history's most famous conflicts are mostly post-war marketing, it leaves you with a significant thought to ponder. How much of the rest of world history that we accept today has been similarly repackaged and streamlined by the victors? Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.